Bishop May, members and friends of the council, when the nominating committee asked me to chair this important committee, I wanted to pass. It has been a privilege to serve in this position, as it is a privilege to bring before you the report of the study committee on homosexuality. I would like to introduce to you those members of the committee who will be making the presentation this morning. Ms. Jean Barnett, Dr. Sally Geis, if you'll stand. Dr. Victor Furnish, Bishop Richard Looney, Dr. Tex Sample, Dr. David Siemens, Dr. Phil Wagaman, and then our GCOM members, Rodolfo Beltran, Jan Bond, Kevin Higgs, Bill Lux, Wesley Williams. This is our group. I'd like to give you a very brief overview of the committee's work. We did have 8 plenary meetings located at different jurisdictions. We read a wide range of written resources for an in-depth study of the issue. Resource persons were brought before the committee to share their expertise in the areas of Bible, theology, ethics, sociology, psychology, and physiology. They represented a diversity of theological positions and a broad variety of scientific perspectives. We also heard the stories and experiences of gays and lesbians and their family members. For we recognize that this issue indeed does affect the lives of many people. We heard from gays and lesbians who are comfortable with their lifestyle, seeking acceptance in church and society. We heard from gays and lesbians who wish to change their lifestyle. We heard from church leaders, representatives of action organizations, which included Good News, Reconciling Congregations, Transforming Congregations, Methodist Federation for Social Action, and Affirmation. And we received numerous communications from across the church, from United Methodists who care and love their church. Although the work has not been easy, it has been fruitful. And for me, and I am sure for many, life-changing. I have learned and I have grown, both intellectually and spiritually. As you know, there were issues on which we differed, and sometimes the discussions became quite heated. Yet I felt we were able to be church, a caring community, seeking to be faithful to the gospel. I wish to thank you for your prayers of discernment during our last meeting at Lake Junaluska. They were effective prayers. There were moments when we got stuck in our process. We had differing opinions, which kept us from progressing. Yet each time we were able to make passage, and then further bonding took place among committee members. Christ's Spirit surely must have been present with us. The last night, we worked until the early morning hours. Some were astonished at the quality of our work at that late hour. We had help. God was with us. I feel that your prayers of discernment contributed toward the integrity of the report that we present to you. And I want to thank you very, very much. We bring our report before you at this time. Jean Barnett coordinated the section titled Human Experiences of Homosexuality. Her panel will make their presentation at this time.
Thank you, Nancy. Homosexuality is not an abstract theory. It is not some concept. It is not some legalistic point. It is human experience that affects millions of people. Sexual orientation is human beings at their core, their personhood. This committee was constantly aware of this and kept this the reality of the human experience before us throughout our study. We began in Dallas, Texas at a hotel, and at one of our first lunches, we were seated around round tables as usual, getting acquainted and getting to know one another and chatting friendly. Bill Lux and I happened to sit next to each other that day. I live in Sacramento, California.
I told Jean that I lived in Manchester, Iowa, but that this month we were spending the time in Phoenix, Arizona. I'd learned that you got just as much exercise playing tennis as you did shoveling snow.
I lived in Phoenix during World War II and graduated from high school there.
Well, the you taxpayers had given me a free cruise in the South Pacific at that time, free meals, free uniforms, and that's where I was at that time. And I said, did you move to California with your husband?
Oh my, I thought. What assumptions in that question? Well, here we go, Jean. I replied, no, I'm a lesbian. I've never been married. I am in a committed couple relationship.
Well, I've met gays and in college and in the Navy. So while Jean was really not new to me, I had never spoken with a lesbian before. And I said I've not met a lesbian in my knowledge, in Iowa at least.
Well, Bill, we're here to learn and understand from one another. Ask anything you wish.
I really wanted to know what was going on inside of her mind, and I wanted to know when and how she became a lesbian. So what I said was, do you think your sexual orientation came from your parents, your home? What happened?
Well, I really smiled at this and said, no, we gave up on that theory a long time ago. And I have shared this story with my friends, pointing out that there's a difference of experience among the members on the committee and different levels of understanding. And so we begin our work together on this committee. But our members had other experiences as well. Rodolfo?
In one of the meetings of the committee to study homosexuality, wherein I am the only member coming from the Central Conference, held at San Francisco, California, USA in 1990. I came into the USA through San Francisco as my port of entry. When I was at San Francisco International Airport, joining the immigration line going out with my baggage, I presented my passport with indefinite multiple visa to the immigration officer, together with my I-94 immigration card and custom card, wherein it was stated that I am on business entering USA. The immigration officer asked me what business I will do in USA. I told him I will be attending the meeting of the committee to study homosexuality. Do you have a letter to that effect? I said, I have. bring it out. So I brought out the letter sent to me by Dr. C. David Langist. He read it, and after reading it, the immigration officer stood up from where he was sitting, went down to the same footing of the floor where I was standing, looked and examined me with his big eyes open from head to foot, and asked me the question in a loud voice, "Are you homosexual?" I made the reply, "No, no, I am not." After an answer, another immigration officer approached me and asked the same question to me, but I gave the same answer. I was jointly asked by the immigration officers to prove at that very moment that I am not homosexual. I proved right then and then in many ways. I told them that since 1968 to the present, I have been entering and going out United States in different port of entries, that my passport have several stamps of admissions in a different port of entry in America, and that my look and appearance, I am one of the human in the Republic of the Philippines. Later on, after the two immigration officers had discussion and conversation, it was only then that my passport was stamped admission. United States immigration law prohibits admission of homosexual persons to your country.
We wanted to hear from as many United Methodist members as we could. So we held listening posts in each jurisdiction. We heard in person from hundreds. We heard from lesbians and gay men, their parents, brothers and sisters, ex-gays, clergy and laity, some boards of ordained ministry, and some district superintendents. In addition, we received hundreds of pieces of mail. Some are in the report. We'll mention others. People shared with us their deeply held beliefs. Most certainly, our United Methodist position and actions have driven lesbians and gay men and their families from the church. A pastor, a father of a lesbian, told us of his 3-year struggle with his wife and daughter when they learned she was a lesbian. He was raised in the South, went to Southern Baptist schools, and was very conservative. And he said he bargained with God, his daughter, the church, and everything that he went through it. But he finally came to accept her as she is, and they have a very good relationship now. And his only regret is that she is not in the church of his. She is very religious, but could not find a place in the United Methodist Church where she was raised. The mother of a gay son, he's a doctor in Washington, D.C., told us that she raised him in the church and was active in the church all her life, went to a meeting where they were had a presentation on homosexuality. The first question in the question period, how can we stop this perverted behavior? She knew her son was not perverted. She was very proud of him, active member of the family. And she said she left that church that day knowing she could not be a part of a church that chooses only a few. And so, as she said in tears, "And now we are nothing." She could not go on at that point and stopped. Clergyman sitting next to her and was the next person to speak said he found himself in a more difficult position than he had anticipated when he came, because he knew what he said would not comfort her as she sought and would add more pain to her. His position is that he believed change is possible. And the promiscuity in homosexuals was stunning to him and sick if we observed it in heterosexual relationships. He hoped that the committee would find that the scripture was confirmed by life
and that in general, homosexuality is not the promise of God's gift of sexuality to folks and not his plan for us. A man spoke to us who said that he didn't care what the committee did. He had left the gay lifestyle 5 years ago and felt that the Spirit of God called him out of homosexuality. We had a delightful man of 73 years old come and talk to us, who'd been active in the church throughout the year, held many positions as a gay man. He said he went through life unfulfilled and felt as though he had one hand tied behind his back his entire life. And he asked that we, on behalf of the young Methodists, encourage them to be themselves and accept them. My family partner and I, Ellie, were at another lunch of this committee, and two clergymen were at the table. They each served different churches, and they both told us that they would not accept Ellie and I as members in their church, would deny us membership. One went on to say that he would also deny membership to a heterosexual couple who was living together without marriage. So my partner, being quick, said, "Will you marry us?" He replied, "No, I can't do that." And then she said, "And what is our option then?" And he shrugged and did not reply. The majority of persons in the in-person presentations favored change in our church's position, and the male was just the opposite. In all, people shared their pain from the church's position, their concerns about homosexuality, their fear of change, and their fear of not changing. Soon here this morning, you will hear from our scholars, and that was very important in our study. But it's also important to keep in mind, in addition to the scholars, our understanding and our knowledge is enriched by the lesbians and gay men in our churches across the denomination. We are not talking about some unknown they. We are talking about us among our membership. Some in the closet, not able to speak out, fearing rejection. Others happily serving, openly welcomed in local churches. And just like heterosexuals, all are not faultless, not notorious. But the number of homosexual persons who truly manifest the fruit of the Spirit cannot be ignored by an honest inquiry into our church's own experience.
After serving on the committee and hearing from people who came to testify at the regional listening post, after knowing friends, after having intimate acquaintances, I realized more than ever that what we come to know about or feel about homosexuality has to do a lot with what we are taught and what we grow up with. South Pacific, that musical, puts it so succinctly, you've got to be carefully taught. One of the things I think that has to be said about life patterns related to the gay and lesbian lifestyle is that it is by no means monolithic. There is, in fact, a great diversity of lifestyles among homosexual persons as among heterosexual persons. And gays and lesbians cannot be defined merely by sexual orientation or practice. Someone asked in one of our settings, what do you think, or one of the settings that I was in, what do you think of when you say the word heterosexual? And we got a whole range of responses. And then the question was followed up on by, what do you think of when you think of the word homosexual? And all of the responses had to do with the bedroom. Monogamy does exist among homosexuals as well as heterosexual couples, despite obvious difficulties. Like interracial marriage, in a sense, couples have to be committed to their relationships in face of overwhelming odds and barriers. There is some evidence of change in some quarters, however. About 3 months ago, the Lotus Corporation announced, and it was on the front page of the Boston Globe, that they were extending joint benefits to gay and lesbian couples. But despite those small changes, there are obvious, overwhelming stumbling blocks. Promiscuity does exist, although the AIDS epidemic has seriously curtailed that lifestyle. And we know also now that the AIDS epidemic has made serious encroachments into the heterosexual world. However, we should not focus just on the promiscuous lifestyle portrayed in the media. The media would have us think that all gays and lesbians are driven by their libido. In fact, the media would have us think that the gay community is made up primarily of young, white, muscle-bound, blonde, blue-eyed, golden-bodied demigods. We know that there is a great ethnic diversity in the gay community. There are Asian gays, there are black gays, there are Hispanic gays who face double indemnity because of a double marginality. Just as inner city, conscientious, creative youth don't get the press very often, neither do quiet, monogamous relationships. I don't think that it's often very persuasive to lift up the lives of famous gays and lesbians, but I do think that at points it is instructive, because many people who we know and love, who have made serious and profound contributions to our own spiritual enlargement, have not only been gay and lesbian, but have lived in monogamous, long-term monogamous relationships. One of my own favorite composers, Sir Benjamin Britten, knighted by the Queen, was in a 25-year relationship with his lover, the celebrated tenor Peter Pears, who, by the way, was sent condolences by the Queen upon Benjamin Britten's death. Sir John Gielgud, the epitome of theater, in a long-term monogamous relationship, and often talked about the support that he received from that relationship. A word has to be said about parenting. As far as lifestyles are concerned, no difference in parenting effectiveness, according to current research results, can be attributed to the sexual orientation of the parents. I would refer you to a very, very fine documentary called We Are Family that was produced by Susan Stanberg, who was also one of the original producers of the National Public Radio's news service, All Things Considered. And in that, she effectively follows three family configurations, all involving gay or lesbian parents, all portraying healthy, and in two of the cases, very healing relationships. I think the last thing that needs to be said about life patterns is that culturally learned gender roles are more relevant to lifestyle choices than sexual orientation. Contrary to popular opinion, gay men's lifestyle are more like straight men's lifestyle. Lesbians' lifestyles are more like straight women. And despite the picture of the highly bedecked sequin bugle bead ostrich feathered queen running the plank, so popularly portrayed in the Torch Song trilogy and all, gays are very, very much into the sports world. I remember last year in the Gay Pride March in Boston, watching with almost incredulity at 25 policemen joining the march. All of this is summed up by an experience that I want to relate to you, that I had with one of my female women clergy friends in Maine, who was appointed to a small church in Maine at about the time that one of the parishioners gave birth to a little boy. And she stayed there for about 7 years. And that was all he knew. This was his pastor. And when she was reappointed, and a man followed her, the little boy looked to his mother with great consternation and said, "Mommy, I didn't know men could be ministers." We've got to be taught before it's too late, before we are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people our relatives hate. We've got to be carefully taught.
It is fitting, I think, following hearing these stories and human situations, that we look, and we did as a committee, looked at the implications for pastoral care. But we really couldn't do that without talking for some time in agreement, and most of you, I think, will be as well, in agreement of God's grace. The care, the congregational care, the pastoral care, comes out of the grace that is free and freely given to each of us, a grace that holds on to us, and as far as I'm concerned, I know will never let us go, no matter what. And if our church is to be a church that is a community of grace, and for me that's what the church is, then it becomes a place of compassion and healing, a place where there is acceptance and hospitality. A place, I guess I would say, that is a home, as is in your material, a home for those who have no home. But as we think about that together, if the church really believes in this kind of grace, then it is the church's response, in the church's response, that we reach out to all people. And the church can be a place for congregational and pastoral care that ministers not only to gays and lesbians, but their parents. When I first entered the committee, I thought of just those individuals. I did not, why, I don't know. I didn't think that, my goodness, the lives, there has been trauma and tragedy for parents, for brothers and sisters, for other relatives. And the church has to be reaching out in care to those people as well. But we as the committee, and I think as all of us are very much aware, are agreed that the pastoral care of persons is an important role for the church. But how we give that care is certainly dependent on the church's moral judgment of homosexual practice. And certainly, we are aware of this. And it is this point where the committee comes down with the one heart, reaching out to all in God's grace, but then also being of two minds.
Nancy Yamasaki has been thrown so many bouquets, I hesitate again to toss another her way. However, her graciousness and forthrightness and everything about Nancy came through as she chaired our committee. Actually, chairing this committee was a piece of cake. We were amenable, gracious, compatible, friendly, and that pretty well characterizes the first 10 minutes of the last 3 years of this committee. And then on we went every which direction. As I look out at what I thought at one time were friendly faces, I know that somebody out there nominated me to be on this committee. With friends like this, who needs? I need to be clear with you where I stand before I say even a sentence about how I feel the church should be ministering to the homosexual practicing community. I believe the church to be a community of grace that extends its compassion of Christ to everybody, in all places, at all times, under all circumstances. I believe God's love is limitless and unrestricted. And I believe that each of us stand convicted of sin. And I have been persuaded over the past 3 years that the practice of homosexuality is sinful. These are some of the reasons why I am persuaded. The committee has spent the past 3 years in 3 and 4 day sessions listening to sociologists, psychologists, theologians, biblical scholars, ethicists, gay and lesbian persons. In addition to their testimony and witness before us, we assembled nationally known scholars in their fields to present written material for our study. Then they came in person to present and dialogue with us. Additionally, we have spent countless hours in our homes and in our offices with the writings of other scholars who have directed their attention to homosexuality. At the end of our study, with respect to the scientific community, we found little or no concurrence in regards to the etiology or the mutability of homosexuality. Leaving the scientific field and turning to the biblical scholars and the theologians who presented before our committee, those persons agreed, and the committee agreed that we heard them in 3 matters. 1, that although Scripture may not address homosexuality or its practice as a major issue, it is addressed in Scripture. 2, that the practice of homosexuality is consistently viewed negatively in Scripture. And 3, that Scripture never affirms the practice of homosexuality. How then does the church minister to that person who affirms a homosexual orientation and practices that, as well as a belief in God, in Jesus Christ, and in our Wesleyan heritage? The church ministers to that person and those persons with the same care and the same compassion and the same reproofs as the church ministers to all of the rest of us. As we affirm human worth, we do not necessarily condone any part of our sinful nature that we allow to persist within us. As the church reaches out to all of us, the church does not abandon Scripture or its admonitions that speak to any part of our nature, regardless of how we acquired that nature. The church, in the wisdom of tradition and experience, reason and Scripture, will not compromise what it stands on to accommodate a lifestyle. Finally, lest any of us who are of heterosexual persuasion take any comfort in the fact that we are not homosexuals, we need be reminded that we tread precariously near the brink of self-righteousness. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. I'd like to quote Albert Outler in what he wrote in 1984 to the Methodist Reporter. In the Bible, which we call our primary norm, there is unanimous condemnation of homosexual practice as unnatural, decadent, associated with pagan licentiousness. If homosexual practice is affirmed by the church, the Bible which condemns the practice will be called into question. Outler further states that our benchmark for beliefs, biblical condemnation then of a practice that Scripture admonishes, cannot be accepted by the church. It was probably a quirk of fate in the selection of this committee that only two or three or four of us present on that committee who entered into the debate held the position that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. But it is. And the church must not alter a position to accommodate a lifestyle that Scripture admonishes and upon which science has reached little agreement.
My comments will be about pastoral care, inclusive of gays and lesbians in the church, in response to the efforts of our committee and my own experience with gay and lesbian friends. I affirm that homosexual relationships are healthy and fulfilling relationships just as their heterosexual counterparts can be. And my comments are, in a sense, the beginnings of how to begin. For me, it is more in first person about how I struggle with pastoral care in my social location. And I hope that there are parallels that you can find in yours. For me, pastoral care is the place in between. It is the place in between my theology and my encounter with other people. In between where I want people to be and where they are. Pastoral care is the reaching out and the receiving of the church. In our church's step into receiving and affirming gay and lesbian people, I believe that the stable and normal expectations and images of pastoral care that we all associate with will be greatly challenged and pushed to their limits. I serve a church as a pastoral assistant in North Alabama, which is a conservative area of our country. It is very much what I would call a church that's in the cultural middle to quote Tex Sample's latest book. Homosexuality is not an experience or lifestyle within my church that is associated with church people. The issue is not discussed and not mentioned except perhaps in a passing joke or reference. The majority of the congregation, I assume, would consider homosexuality as wrong or even sinful. The small minority that differ in opinion are comfortable in remaining quiet and being passive about the issue. The leadership in my church does not initiate discussion or study of homosexuality, I believe, because the topic is uncomfortable and a subject that would offend some of my members. Perhaps your church is like mine. Yet underneath the stable and normally defined congregational life, there are stories that are not spoken, pain and grief stuffed down and not shared. Perhaps you can relate to some of these. The story of a woman in divinity school who resigns her candidacy because she is a lesbian and her family no longer accepts her, and her pastor in her local church will not discuss it with her and will not discuss it with her church members. Or the story of the pain and isolation of a family who has been ostracized by their congregation because their son came out as gay and he no longer feels welcome in his home church. Or perhaps the conversation that I had recently with a family that I know well and discovered that there is another daughter that I did not know about who lives in another city and who I have never seen in church and is never discussed. And later, I found out that she is a lesbian. Pastoral care and reaching out. Questions for me. How do I break the silence? How do I encourage thoughtful discussion about homosexuality? How do I manage the criticism and fear within the congregation of even confronting the issue, let alone embracing these people? And how do I confront the fear within myself of taking the risk and accepting the consequences of saying what I believe is true, that homosexual people are a beautiful part of God's good creation? Clergy and laity together, for us to bridge the gap of fear and begin to break down the wall of suspicion, I believe it would be helpful for us to begin with new images and metaphors about how we can be in pastoral care, in ministry, in an inclusive way to homosexual people. New images of ministry would help us fill that in-between gap that is pastoral care. I will let an image guide me in how and what I will say and how I interpret what I believe to others. There are three images of pastoral care that I'll go over now. The first in dealing with homosexuality for me is the image I call the patient teacher. I would be the teacher that seeks to model and encourage the grace of listening. Listening to all sides and attempting prayerfully to create an atmosphere where opinions are welcome, all opinions, an environment where the reality of homosexuality can be discussed in its totality. The second image is that of the beloved liberator. The most important here is beloved. One moment that I remember very clearly is my professor, Dr. Liston Mills at Vanderbilt, said that if people you serve love you and respect the integrity of your words, then they will listen to you and think about what you say, even if they disagree with you. Through the grace of God, it can happen that through the power of my words and my service and my abiding, continuing love for my congregation, that I can help to begin to liberate my brothers and sisters from their separation from homosexual people. This liberation can begin to happen through the normal life of the congregation, perhaps through an illustration in a sermon that has a healing, supportive statement about who gay and lesbian people are, by responding to a conversation or a joke about homosexual people in some positive way, by being present and supportive of parents who are working through their struggles of a child who has come out. The last image is a more familiar one, that of the wounded healer. This image works on many levels, as I'm sure you know. But for me, first, by speaking out and being heard as one who is supportive of gay and lesbian people means that I risk being wounded. It might mean that I lose connection with some people, that I break the momentum that I have built up in my ministry and my congregation, or it might be worse. But by taking this risk of being wounded, then I am opening the door for others in all of our brokenness who are already wounded, who can go on through the door with me. And as wounded people together, we can begin to tell the story. Those wounded by the stigma of their sexual orientation or by the pain and hurt within their family can begin to struggle together and with one another can begin to be healed. As Henry Nouwen assures us, a Christian community can be a healing community, not in that these wounds are alleviated, but that these wounds and pains become openings and occasions for a new vision of who we can be as the church. The paradox of the image is that as the wounded healer, that I, in taking this risk, encourage others to risk as well. And together we can heal our church, heal ourselves. Pastoral care, reaching out in between where we are, will be the point of breakthrough. When we connect with other people, we begin to overcome separation. We can reach out We can listen patiently and risk touching people we do not know and try to walk humbly with each other in respect of others. Pastoral care with gay, straight, hurt, angry, healthy, sick people can begin when the Christ in me can see the Christ in you. There begins reconciliation.
Homosexuality is not an abstract theory or concept or a legalistic point. It is human experience that affects millions. Our committee was constantly aware of that. We hope you will be.